Well, let me ask you, when's the last time you thought about work? No, I mean really thought about work. Or maybe we could emphasize the word about. When's the last time you thought about work? However you'd want to emphasize it. Imagine that you're at a social event talking with a small group of people about work. And I don't just mean occupations and jobs, but your present life's work, whether you're an unemployed college student or a high school student even, or a stay-at-home mom or a retiree. Everyone has chimed in with their comments and their anecdotes about their work in this little gathering. And then someone looks at you directly and says, "So why do you work? Why do I work?" I mean, you're thinking, do you live with your mom? What do you mean, why do I work? Do you live in a van down by the river? I mean, what do you mean, why do I work? Did you inherit a lot of money or something? Is this guy for real? Well, that's our question today. Why work? And let me ask you this. Would your answer to that question, why work, be any different if you were or were not a Christian? Or, as I asked already, when's the last time you thought about work? And of course, some of us chuckled, well, this morning or yesterday or maybe at the latest by Friday afternoon. Did you think about your work in a distinctly Christian, biblical way? Or do you think about your work in basically the same way that anyone in this world thinks about work? We're in a study of the book of Proverbs, as you probably know, and Proverbs talks a lot about work, but basically all of its verses about work fall into two categories. Hard work is good, laziness is bad. It's really just that simple in Proverbs, but you know it's not just that simple in your own life. It may be, especially in 21st century America, maybe it's not that we need more work. Maybe we're an overworked society, and maybe our problem isn't laziness so much, at least like Proverbs talks about it. So Proverbs isn't irrelevant, but Proverbs is assuming something about work, many things about work, that are in the Bible and are part of God's plan, His creation, part of His fingerprint in this world. And Proverbs, as I said, assumes them rather than interacts with them. So what we'll have to do in this study is look at some Proverbs, but also look at other passages in Scripture so that we understand this basically biblical theology of work, a whole Bible theology of work. And by the way, when I say work, I don't mean job. I don't mean occupation. That includes your occupation, but again, it could be a college student or a stay-at-home mom or a retiree or even kids. In different seasons of your life, you have more or less work and leisure. So all of us have a cycle of work and leisure and sleep. Even our 3-year-old son has to do some things. He has to pick up some things, put some things away, take his dish over carefully to the countertop when he's done with his meal. All of us have work. So this message is for everybody, not just those with a certain kind of job. And my goal is not modest. My goal is to get you to do your work and to view your work with radically more joy and fulfillment and purpose and worship. So if you want to follow along on the sermon notes page, the first thing to consider is that our work is creational. We've got to go back to the beginning. Our work is creational. It's rooted in creation. You see, God works powerfully and creatively and happily in the creation story. It says in Genesis 1:31, God saw all that he made, and behold, it was very good. He made it intricately. He made it powerfully. He made it wisely. He made it beyond our comprehension. We're still figuring it out every day. He made it happily, too. When it was all done, he said it was very good. He was pleased with it. He knew it was good. It made him glad. Now, we work because God works. We work because we were made in God's image. Genesis 1, God says, "Let us make man in our own image, according to our likeness." And God created man in his own image. In verse 28 of Genesis 1, it says, "God blessed them and said to them, 'Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves on the earth.'" You see, being made in God's image means a few different things. It means that we were made to worship. It means that we were made to be relational. It means that we were made to be emotional. It means basically that we're different than the animals. And one way we're different than the animals is that we, in His image, create. We, in His image, sustain. We order. We subdue. We're told to multiply. God could have made a creation of people just like He did Adam and Eve. Guys out of the dirt, girls out of the ribs. He didn't. He made one couple and then told them to make others. Now, in a sense, they don't make them like God made them. You know, if you were asked of your child, "Who made that child?" you'd say, "Well, we did, and God did. Both are true." And Adam and Eve are called to be fruitful and multiply because that's what God does. And they're told to rule over it because that's what God does. They are His ambassadors, His emissaries in this world, doing His work on His behalf. It's what it means to be made in His image. It's work to subdue things and to rule over things. I don't know if you know Dorothy Sayers, that amazing Oxford essayist, theologian, playwright of the last century. I came across an article she has on work this week called "Why Work?" Listen to this. She says, "Work should not be looked upon as a necessary drudgery to be undergone for the purpose of making money, but as a way of life in which the nature of man should find its proper exercise and delight, and so fulfill itself to the glory of God, that it should, in fact, be thought of as a creative activity undertaken for the love of the work itself, and that man, made in God's image, should make things as God makes them, for the sake of doing well a thing that is worth doing well." Well put, isn't it? God has made us differently than the animals. God has made us to do work. Animals do work. But we do work with something of the fingerprint of God within us. We'll unpack what Dorothy Sayers says basically as we go through this. But just notice up front how different this is than any modern concept of work, where we work in order to enjoy that time when we're not working. We work because we have to. We work to get money so we can have fun when we're not working. We work in order to not work. Or, you know, as the old 70s, 80s song says, everyone's working for the weekend, right? Okay, now what keeps us from the ideals of what Dorothy Sayers says and instead buys into a different culture of work? Well, work is corrupted. The second point, our work is corrupted. Now, sin's curse has complicated our work, but sin's curse in the Bible didn't create work, it didn't invent work, it didn't either destroy work. Work, on Adam and Eve's part, is there in creation before sin ever enters the world. So you know that there's a curse that's on sin, rather there's a curse that's on work because of sin. But that curse didn't create work, it just complicated it and corrupted it. Now notice, God cursed work that it would be filled with difficulty and futility so that we would know something's wrong with this world on a cosmic level. God was gracious to make work sometimes futile and sometimes frustrating so that we would in everyday life have a very frequent reminder, this world just ain't right. Genesis 3 puts it like this. God said to Adam, "Because you've listened to the voice of your wife and you've eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, saying, 'You shall not eat from it,' cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you'll eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it'll grow for you. And you'll eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you will eat your bread. The ground is cursed. It'll take toil to reap it. Thorns and thistles will be in the ground. And this isn't just related to agriculture. This is when your hard drive crashes too. It's just that Adam and Eve didn't have hard drives. They didn't know the blue screen of death. You know it, and you should not be surprised by it. It's part of the curse in this world. When you're trying to fix something at your home and you think you can do it, and then after money spent and a lot of time spent, you find out you can't do it and you have to call the professional electrician or professional plumber. That's part of the curse in this world. It has something of futility. It has something of frustration in it. It's not just that the ground is cursed. That's just the work that Adam and Eve were obviously given to do. But there are thorns and thistles, proverbial thorns and thistles in your work, whatever work that is, and no matter what the pay is or how sophisticated it is. Now, work is corrupted with difficulty, but sin in this world also shows itself where work becomes either too important or too unimportant. You see, sin's effect in this world is not just that work is frustrating and sometimes futile. It's also that work now can be either utterly neglected, where we ignore God's fingerprint on this calling and this identity, this image that we're given. Or it can be so idolized that it becomes basically a substitute for God. Work can be sinfully ignored or neglected. And in Proverbs, this is the sluggard. Proverbs 6 talks about the sluggard. It's him who loves sleep more than even food. Proverbs 12, verse 24. The hand of the diligent will rule, but the slack hand will be put to forced labor. Some hands won't work unless you force them to. And by the way, that relates to kids as well. So sometimes force them to do labor by, you know, as a means of them getting and knowing and appreciating the purposes of God in work. Proverbs 18:9. He who is slack in his work is brother to him who destroys. Destroying, that's bad, that's destructive. Well, him who doesn't work, he's not fighting the curse. He's not putting things in order. He's not doing God's work like God works. Well, it's brother to him who destroys. Or Proverbs 21, verse 25. The desire of the sluggard puts him to death, for his hands refuse to work. All day long he's craving, while the righteous gives and does not hold back. You see, the sluggard in Proverbs craves. He still wants. He just is so selfish that he wants and doesn't want to work for it. It's a double selfishness. You're selfish, you could say, when you really want to work in order to have. Paul says in Ephesians 4:28 that you shouldn't steal. Instead, you should work hard with your hands. And you should work in order to have, in order to have, in order to what? Give. To meet needs. But here, the sluggard isn't interested in meeting others' needs like the righteous. He's still craving, but he even refuses to work. So many other proverbs are like this. It just gives us a glimpse of it. But I think our contemporary problem of laziness is slightly different than what you see of these passages in Proverbs about the sluggard, the one who loves sleep. Maybe some do really, really love sleep. We'll talk about sleep and rest and leisure next week, Lord willing. But I think in our contemporary age, the more predominant problem, and maybe even more so among young people, is what I'd call e-laziness, electronic laziness. You know, sitting in front of the TV, no work. It's not like they, you know, worked really hard, their mind is tired, and they just decide to watch something to kind of rest or something like that. No, but just to veg and just to tune out, or just to get on the internet and just, you know, just wander, not accomplish anything, not even discover anything new, just wander, just look at the headlines about, you know, Paris Hilton this or Britney that, or video games. There is a real contemporary problem of e-laziness that parents need to address in terms of it being a contemporary version of the proverbial sluggard. So when Proverbs talks about what will happen to the sluggard may look different in our e-culture, but its effects, the destruction of that e-laziness, are not much different. That's when work is sinfully ignored. But work can be sinfully idolized. You can love the work itself. You can love what the work produces. You can love the accomplishment or the identity of it. I think you see this in Genesis 4. Early on, right after the fall, and right after it records the spread of people in this world. It says this in verse 16. Then Cain settled in the land of Nod, and he built a city. And then it says, Ada gave birth to Jabal, the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. You see what's happening here? Identity. It's not just the niche of work. It's not just the sophistication of work among special people, the specialization of work. What's going on is, I think, a subtle hint that this is identity. This is becoming their name. This is becoming what they're known for. His brother, Jubal, was the father of all those who play the lyre and the pipe. And the artist of the family. He's one who's playing the lyre and the pipe. And Zillah gave birth to Tubal-Cain, the forger of all implements of bronze and iron. What's interesting in these verses is that there's no mention of God. It's just a mention of what they're known for and what they do. That's loving the work itself or idolizing the accomplishment of the identity that work produces. You can also love what work produces in money, but keep in mind what Proverbs 24 says. Or rather, Proverbs 23, verse 4. Do not weary yourself to gain wealth. Cease from your consideration of it. Like 1 Timothy 6 that warns of those who desire to get rich. They'll fall into various snares and troubles. Proverbs 23 says, when your eyes are set on your wealth or in pursuing wealth, it's gone. For wealth certainly makes itself wings like an eagle that flies toward the heavens. Don't invest too much. I don't mean don't invest money. I don't mean don't have a savings account. I don't mean don't have a retirement fund. But don't invest too much energy and time in something that has inherent wings. It just disappears. You say, how'd it go away? You know, what if the stock market crashes tomorrow and some of you would lose hundreds of thousands of dollars or tens of thousands of dollars? Just boom, gone. What? How did that happen? Well, it has wings. It flew away. It's in Proverbs. We have a place for that. Or maybe your situation is not such where you love what work produces, i.e. money, but you love what work produces, i.e. the image. Maybe the work you've chosen to do is related to both the money it'll produce and also the prestige of it. Remember the first Rocky? I was watching the first Rocky with Will, my son, not too long ago, and I thought about when Rocky says to Adrian, I want to go the distance so I know I'm not a bum. He wants to go the distance with Apollo Creed so he knows he's not a bum. Okay. You went the distance, and then we had to do 6 other Rocky movies. Because you have to keep telling yourself you're not a bum, right? You know what that is? That is the pursuit, the hard work pursuit, eye of the tiger pursuit of wanting to just know you're not a bum and wanting others to know that you're not a bum. Work can be sinfully despised as well. And I don't mean neglected. I just mean thoughtlessly underappreciated. So you go about your work, but it's just drudgery. And part of this isn't surprising. Because there is that element of futility and frustration inherent now in work because of the curse. Ecclesiastes 2. For what does a man get in all his labor and in his striving with which he labors under the sun? What's he going to get for it? Well, all his days, his task is painful and grievous. Even at night, his mind does not rest. This too is vanity or emptiness. We shouldn't be surprised that more work leads to more worry oftentimes. And even when it leads to more money, well, that money has wings and sometimes picks up and flies. Solomon elsewhere said in Ecclesiastes, what if you even have it all through your life? Then what do? You give it to someone else who didn't work for it. They're not going to appreciate it like you do, and who knows how they'll use it. So part of it's not surprising that work can be despised or underappreciated, but part of it, again, is that modern concept of work we have, whether we're Christians or not, this is predominant in our culture, that we work because we have to, that you work to make money so that you can do what you really want to do, so that you work so you don't have to work, and maybe even have 20 years at the end where you don't have to do any work. The goal would be to hammock it for the last 20 years on in to the hospital bed and there end your life. Well, there's nothing wrong with retirement per se, but I don't think you should want to hammock it on in to the kingdom. You see, no one today works for the thing that they do. We work because we have to, and what we want to do is maybe find a job that pays the best and is at least tolerable. We don't expect it to be fulfilling. We don't expect it to do anything. If I said, what does your work do for others? You would maybe describe it in economic terms. You'd maybe describe it in terms of just goods produced, and that's it. Now, I think we know that we work to provide for self and family. I think we know that. I think we know that it's good. Don't miss that. I think we should know, as I said also, Ephesians 4:28, that we work in order to have, in order to give. But what about the work itself? What we seem to acknowledge even less in our culture is that our work itself is to be consecrated. The work itself, not just what it produces. The work itself being good. So our third point, our work is to be consecrated, set apart, made holy. What we just sang, take my life and let it be consecrated to you. Take my hands, take my feet. What if we sang that in terms of our work, our business dealings? Any work can be consecrated. In Scripture, I don't know if there's separation of the sacred and the secular as it relates to calling, as it relates to church work and then everything else. We tend to think about it in terms of maybe three categories. Among Christians today, I would say most would say there are three categories for work. There's sinful work, prostitution, you're in the mob, you're a professional thief. That kind of thing. You're in the porn industry, something like that. You just know that's kind of, you can't go there. And then there's church work where he's really doing God's work. And then there's everything else in between. And that stuff in between is the stuff that most of us do. And we do it just because we have to. But the real kingdom work is when you can get out of work or leave work early and then go do something for church. If I asked you, what is God's work? I think you might say, well, I don't know. It'd be working at a church. It'd be working at a ministry. 1 Corinthians 10:31, though, says whether you eat or drink or whatever you do. And not whatever you do for your occupation, but whatever you do specifically. Whatever graph you come up with. Whatever thing you invent. Whatever thing you try to subdue, do it to the glory of God. Or listen to Colossians 3. Paul says we should obey those who are our masters or our bosses on the earth, not with external service, as those who merely please men. Now, most of us, that's the way we go about it. External service, merely please men. So that the smile at work, well, it's there because either you want a raise, you want a good performance, or you don't want to lose your job. And this is part of this job you have. Every now and then the boss comes in and you have to be on and you have to smile. And your boss, frankly, doesn't care whether it's in your heart. Does he? I mean, if you do your work and you're nice and you're on time and you're happy about it, you're pleasant to be around, he doesn't really care what the heart motives are for it, right? He doesn't care. But we are to be different people. We are to be people with sincerity of our hearts, fearing the Lord. And whatever we do, we are to do our work heartily, as for the Lord rather than for man, knowing that from the Lord we receive the reward of inheritance. It is the Lord Christ whom you serve. Oh, that we would just have that imprinted on our brains throughout our day, and that it would surface again in the hardest of times of whatever occupation or whatever tasks you do. It is the Lord Christ you serve. It is the Lord Christ you serve. When it seems so futile, when it seems so hard, when it seems so hopeless, when it seems like you work with a bunch of buffoons. Have you seen the commercial of the guy who works with all the monkeys or chimpanzees? I love that commercial. You know, they're turning graphs around and jumping all around. And some of you feel like that, right? You don't serve chimpanzees. You really don't even serve the best of bosses in this world. It is the Lord Christ whom you serve. That is work which can be and should be consecrated. Our work also is to be restorative work. Restorative work, restoring shalom or peace in God's plan. Cornelius Plantinga has a great book on sin, and he says, sin is the absence of shalom in this world. Shalom is that pervasive peace which we've talked about already from the book of Proverbs. It's peace with God. It's peace with others. It's peace in society. It's peace within our hearts. It's peace in our relationships. Sin is the absence of shalom. Shalom in God's redemption is not just personal. It's not just Him forgiving you. It's not just Him reconciling Himself to you. That's important. We should never minimize it. But we tend, as conservative evangelicals, to emphasize that and miss what our liberal counterparts emphasize a little bit more, that God is using subtle, ordinary, what we might call secular things in His plan of redeeming His creation. His redemption is redeeming people, but it's also redeeming creation. Colossians 1 says He's reconciling all things to Himself, whether things on earth or things in heaven. Or listen to Hebrews 2. What it says to God regarding Jesus, you have put all things in subjection under His feet. For in subjecting all things to Him, He left nothing that is not subjected to Him. All things are going to be subjected to Him. They are in principle subjected to Him. But look, now we do not yet see all things subjected to Him. You join as God's image bearers and as Christ's personal emissaries. You join Him in His work of getting things to be seen as under His subjection. Part of that is seeing people come to believe in the Lord Jesus, moving from darkness to light, them bowing and confessing that Jesus Christ is Lord and Savior. Part of it is what we call evangelism, and part of it is cleaning. Part of it is street sweeping. It is moving anything from chaos to order. God's plan for you in this world is not just that you work so you can hurry up and get home and be a good family man, or that you can serve the church more necessarily. God's plan for you includes you being His emissary in this world in ordinary ways, seeing all things in your life being subjected to Jesus and under His feet. Again, Dorothy Sayers, she says, work is a celebration of the material world. Have you thought of that? Work as a celebration of the material world, and the material world is not bad. It is fallen, but it is not inherently bad. The goal is not to get away from the physical, to just get spiritual with God. Paul says to the church in Thessalonica, they should work with their hands. Why do you see hands? Because it was common Roman culture at that time, a common concept that good work, real lofty work, was getting away from the physical. If you could do something that had speech involved or was just using your brain, I mean, being a philosopher was the ultimate thing of the day. What you would really think as lowly is anything where you work with your hands. And we, in our culture, have a very intricate system. We may not all agree on it, but we have an intricate system of that job is more prestigious than this job. Oh, that job? You do that? You clean up trash? Cleaning up trash? Cleaning up trash is a beautiful way of moving from chaos to order. It's restoring things to the created order that it was intended to be before sin came into this world. You say, okay, well, that's encouraging, but as I move it from chaos to order, guess what happens? Right back to chaos. Yeah. And that's when we remember that the fall has happened, that the curse is still in this world, but it doesn't diminish the work we're called to do. It doesn't diminish the importance of the kind of work we're called to do. We should work to help other people. Our work should help other people for the greater common good, even societal common good. I like that show, Dirty Jobs, with Mike Rowe on the Discovery Channel. It's just interesting because it's, you know, dirty and funny, but I like when he talks about the purpose of the show. I've heard it a few times on the show, and so I went on the web this week to see what it says on their website about why the show exists. Here it is. To confirm the value of delayed gratification, sacrifice, hard work, good humor, and optimism. To gain a new understanding and appreciation for all the often unpleasant functions someone is shouldering to make your everyday life easier, safer, and often cleaner. I wonder if he's a Christian, because that sounds pretty good. Again, Dorothy Sayers, work is the gracious expression of creative energy in the service of others. Again, we in our culture prize the amount of the salary and the level of prestige that goes with the work. We think that the mundane, we think that the working with hands is not so noble. And we think that any work, whether it pay a lot, whether it pay little, whether it be working with your mind or working with your hands, that's one thing, but it's secular unless you do church work. But what if all of it was part of God's plan to love God and love neighbor? Think of this in terms of the two greatest commandments. Think of anything you do, anything you have to do this afternoon, or anything that's first on your to-do list for Monday morning, and think of it in terms of do it with love for God with all heart and soul and mind and strength, the first of the greatest commandments. And the second, do it loving your neighbor as yourself. What can you do in your work that can't be seen as an expression of putting order in God's creation, or which can't be seen as loving someone, it being in service? Maybe it's someone you don't know. It doesn't have to be in the hospitality business. It doesn't have to be working at Starbucks and handing someone a much-needed coffee because they have a caffeine addiction, and they say, give me coffee, and you say, I love you, neighbor. Here you go. Help that brother out. And they're on their way. Yeah, sometimes it's very hands-on, and sometimes it's more abstract. Sometimes it's economics, which is for the neighbors of our country, or even for our globe. You see, we see work as us giving our time and our work to this thing, someone else's job, someone else's business, or just something I have to do, but we do it in order to get. Martin Luther had the concept of the mask of God in all of life, that God is hidden in all these little things. All these little experiences, all these little work things we do, that God is in them. That people are a mask of God, where He's hidden. It means He's there, but He is not immediately seen. We have to do the mind work of remembering that God is behind this. He's in this. Remember what Jesus said in Matthew 25, the parable of separating the sheep from the goats? He said, what you've done to the least of them, you've done it, what? Unto me. Remember the rhetorical response that Jesus gives? He will say, when did we do it to you? And say, when you've done it to the least of them, you've done it unto me. What if you saw your work in serving others as an expression of serving Christ directly? Read Matthew 25 again if you need the reminder of what Jesus says there. Or think of how God works to answer the prayer in the Lord's Prayer of give us this day our daily bread. Give us our daily food. Think of all of the ordinary, normal ways God answers that prayer request in your life. I mean, it's part of an economic system. I mean, truckers are involved in this. Again, street sweepers, road fixers. I mean, you just think of everything that goes into you getting food. Your paycheck, but God gave you the ability to work. God gave you that place to work. It's the mask of God where we do it unto others as unto Him, and where we see that He is in and He works through a lot of the little normal means to give us our daily bread. The fourth thing is that work is to be a calling. A calling. We need an awakening to the original concept, reformational concept of vocation. If I said, what's your vocation? You'd tell me what your job is, I bet. Vocation, the word means calling. That's what the word means. Vox, Latin, call. You're calling. It means that there's a sanctity in ordinary work, which we've already been talking about. You should just think of it in terms of calling. God has called you to a specific place, to a specific thing in His world. Think of it in terms of the body of Christ, where He has made all of us different. He's equipped us for different things. We should work in an area for which we were made. Yes, we should work to God's glory. We've talked about that. We should work in a way that serves our neighbor and contributes to the common good. We've talked about that. But we should work in an area that we're passionate about. That's okay. Work doesn't have to be just feeling like a right-handed person swinging the bat left-handed. You know, if you see me ever do a left-handed swing, it's just really sad. It's, you know, I look like the most uncoordinated girl in the world trying to swing this. Sorry, ladies, I shouldn't have said that. Come on, you all know. Ask your husbands. He'll say the same thing if he's brave enough to. All right. Something we were made for, something we're passionate about, something we like doing, something we're good at even. Now, you say, I'm glad you're telling me that now. Thanks a lot. I apparently went the wrong path, and I'm 55. Well, there is a spectrum of jobs for specific gifting. You shouldn't think that God calls you to third grade teaching and not fourth grade teaching. But you know those who are quintessential teachers. God put them on this earth to be teachers. Remember in Chariots of Fire? I can't think of the guy's name. I haven't seen this in years. But the one that's going to be a missionary. He says, God made me to be a missionary and I want to preach His gospel. But He also made me fast. And when I run, I feel His pleasure. Do you feel pleasure in certain things that you do? For some of you, that may mean that you need to adjust your work. You need to rethink what you do. Maybe it means that a woman, a wife, a mother needs to move from full-time work to being a stay-at-home mom. Or maybe it means that you know you're not good with paperwork, you hate it, but it pays well and you can at least do it, but you're miserable in it, you're sick of it. Maybe you're at a place of business where you're not sure how it's serving anybody and you think there's possibly this opportunity out there, who knows, where you could move and do different work and it might pay less. It might pay less. Are you okay with that? Again, why do you do what you do? We should work where God has us right now. That's the other side of the coin. You were made to do something. You were made with unique gifts. But you should also keep in mind that the providence of God has led you where He's led you, and it must be acknowledged and not despised. You can't be too quick to think that at this stage of your life, all hope is lost. You went down the wrong path. You blew it. I wish someone had told me about vocation when I was 17. I wish that. I didn't hear about this until I was later in life. Thankfully, I think that I'm doing what God has called me to do. You may say, I don't know if that's true. Friend, don't worry about that. Remember that God, in His providence, has called you and directed your steps in such a way that He's led you to where you are right now. So don't make the mistake of keep thinking that the next occupation will satisfy, the next one will be fulfilling. The next one will really serve neighbor. Or, okay, I'm going to go into the ministry. I'm going to work at a church. I'm going to work for a ministry. God doesn't call us all to do that, or none would be left in this world. And the last point here is that our work must be centered on Christ and His work. You see, idolizing work or giving up on work points to the sin problem. And it points to the gospel hope. Think about this. Work does come up in the Bible related to salvation, right? I mean, there's a way of working your way to God where you're worried, where you're striving, you're trying for God to be pleased with you based on your work, spiritual work per se. But you know, there's also a kind of giving up on that work that is also sinful and wrong. It's a kind of spiritual nudity that says, I don't need any covering. It's a kind of spiritual laziness that says, I don't need to please Him even if He's out there. Both of those are wrong, but both of those are ways we try to deal with a conscious problem that we have. A problem within us that knows something's wrong, knows that there's sin in this world. We know something's wrong, and most of us go in one extreme or another, maybe not to the nth degree, but we start heading down these paths of either working so that God will like us, so He'll maybe receive us into heaven, or making up the idea that He's not there, or even if He is there, who is He to tell me what to do? I don't need to work for Him. The biblical answer is that Jesus worked on our behalf. The gospel is not either work your way to God or be a sluggard for God. But instead, it's rest in the work that Jesus did. And in light of that rest, you join Him in His work. You rest. Come unto me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest for your weary souls, Jesus said. Weary, heavy laden. Those are the descriptions of a work-loaded person. Jesus says, when you get to that point, when you're hungry and thirsty, but you know you don't have any money anymore, come unto me. Be satisfied. Rest. We're told throughout Scripture, especially in Romans 3, in Romans 4, in Romans 5, that in God's salvation economy, it's not according to your work, but according to belief, faith. You don't work your way to God, but now having rested in His work, we work with Him in His work. Not work in order to be His children, just like it was with creation. How many of you were involved in creation? None here, not even Adam and Eve. God created, and Adam and Eve were called to follow in God's work. His gracious work provided them the context for their image-bearing work. Jesus Christ is making a new creation, and He creates out of nothing a new kingdom, a new heaven, a new earth. You get in by resting. You get in by being born into it. And now, having been forgiven of our waywardness, He calls us to do that work which He does, of reconciling people unto Himself and reconciling stuff unto Himself, and glorify Him in eating and drinking and sleeping and in working and whatever we do. We've been saying throughout the series in the book of Proverbs that God is zealous and God is jealous to show forth more of His glory in seemingly ordinary and simple and just plain physical, creational kinds of things, like eating and like work so far. Next week, like sleep and leisure. Let me qualify this quickly and just anticipate the question. You'd say, that sounds awful Pollyanna. You know, it sounds like that's a nice locker room pep talk. I'm going to go out and I'm going to do something in my garage this afternoon and it's still going to stink. Still not going to like it. I know. But this is where we fight the battle, friend. This is where the battle is fought. We can't presume that the curse isn't out there anymore or that sin isn't in here anymore. But we have an explanation for why things are hard in this world. And as Christians, we have an extra double category, we could say, of why things could be hard in your work. When you stand up for truth, you might get more persecution. Work might be harder for you than it is for an unbeliever at times in different ways. In some ways, you could say, my burden can be light. They can fire me. Jesus will provide for me. You can be light about that. But you know what? There are other times where you're the one that discovers the fraud. What are you going to do? You're going to fear God or you're going to fear man? You obey God. You fear Him. You don't fear man. You don't fear the consequences. And it's hard. It is hard. Yeah, we're not in heaven yet. We're not in heaven yet. So we shouldn't be surprised when it's hard, and we shouldn't be overcome by its hardness, which means also no complaining, no murmuring. How many of us hang out at the water cooler at work and murmur just like unbelievers do? God help us.